doing it, and I'm going to keep ignoring it. You know, we've had her Bible class leader, which is an 86-year-old man, talk to her. She's about 80. You know, it probably won't change till she dies.
Right? For those listening to the tape, we're having a discussion.
He's going to edit this out.
Well, this is a useful discussion, in my opinion, because it's partly how we use church history. Let me share an example. About 5 years ago or so, there was a gentleman in the Palmetto region in San Diego. The bottom line is he couldn't get baptized. And so the leadership came to me and asked. And I said, well, we should do a pouring.
Right.
Just do a pouring.
Like physically he wasn't able to get
right.
Okay.
And but for the Church of Christ, they just would not be able to accept that.
Right.
And but
pull somebody down into a swimming pool, you know.
Yeah. And so I'm proud of the leadership in San Diego. They asked the question. And so I even read them from the Didache, which is not even a scriptural document. I said, here's something that was being done at the end of the first century. I'm not saying it's biblical. And this is how they dealt with it. And by the way, the first Anabaptists poured, did not immerse. The very, very first Anabaptists did not immerse. They reached immersion just very shortly afterward.
I think the thing I came away most from the previous class was this idea of expedience. And so I started looking at everything and go, wow, that's an expedient. And I would look at it and go, okay, you know what? I understand why this was put in place. I understand why the bishops became so important, so elevated.
Yeah.
It makes sense, right? The idea to protect the church, to protect the flock, to protect the scripture, but then how quickly that can become something terrible.
Right. Our expedient, you know, can become a doctrine.
How quickly human nature takes over, you know?
And keep that thought whenever we get into art history. Mm-hmm. Because of our flat hermeneutic that was a reaction to the traditional church crisis.
Right.
Then the pendulum of expediency, I think,
we went too far toward expedience, yeah. No question about it.
Yeah, I always felt that way after the letter. I was prior and after, and I always felt like, you know, I understood where some of these things came from. And absolutely, they went way too far, got out of hand, people took advantage, and there's power abuses and all that. But I understood somewhere at the point, there was a point of, I want to protect the flock. I want to help someone. I want to help someone avoid the mistake I made. You know, I always understood this. I never got too crazy with the reaction of, you know, that some people took.
It's funny, at our teachers' meeting, I don't know if you were there when we had this discussion, but at the teacher group we were discussing, so what is our hermeneutic? And you know, I want to propose, but didn't have time. I go back to Roger Bacon, induction, deduction, revelation. And so revelation is, thus says the Lord. Deduction is, here's a principle, so let's apply it. And then induction is, well, let's learn from experience. But the order is revelation first, and then deduction. You know, thus says the Lord trumps principle. But then where principle is not clearly there, then we have to go based on experience. But there's a certain person, him who is not to be named, who basically said expediency basically overcomes principle. He didn't put expediency in the place of doctrine. But he did put expediency in the place of principle, which is an overreaction. But that we're getting in trouble here. All right. So, Zwingli, just so you know, this, if you want to understand Protestantism, don't go to Martin Luther. Attention. If you want to understand Protestantism, don't go to Martin Luther, go to Ulrich Zwingli. All right, Protestantism today on about a 70, 80, 90, somewhere in there, 80, 90% level, Protestantism is defined by Zwingli, not by Luther. Okay? The only denomination influenced by Luther is Lutheranism, and to some extent Anglicanism. All right. Whereas all other Protestant denominations primarily trace their roots back to Zwingli. Yeah.
You're moving on from Luther.
Let's talk about Luther. Sure.
The thing that I appreciate about Lutheranism And it may not be directly from Martin Luther. Probably isn't. Probably Philip Melanchthon. But is the idea of dialectic. It isn't black and white in Lutheranism today. It's that tension between truths and the idea of dialectic.
That's definitely Melanchthon.
Yeah. And that's where Richard Hughes he said at one time, I might be a bit of a closet Lutheran because of dialectic.
And by the way, and Eastern Orthodox versus Catholic anytime.
Right.
Totally.
And I just want to make sure I understand what you're saying. So dialecticism, that's like just you and me kind of working through the scriptures together kind of thing?
It's like
two things are true at the same time.
Hegel. That's Hegel's philosophy, right. Dialectic stuff, yeah. Like James and Ephesians. I think there is a healthy dialectic between those two.
Life and doctrine.
Yeah.
Okay. Grace and truth. Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Very smart. You're getting some brownie points on that one. That's so good. Zwingli. All right. Zwingli very humbly said, I'm not a Lutheran, for I had learned Greek before I ever heard of the name Luther. Do you feel what's going on there? You know, but it's true. He was not a Lutheran. Now, who influenced who more? Did Luther influence Zwingli more? Or did Zwingli influence Luther more? That's a good question. Zwingli's Reformation started earlier than that of Luther, but his Reformation was far more gradual. I would say. The world at that time, at the immediate context of the 15-teens and 20s, Luther was the man. That's true. But ultimately, Zwingli's thought, Zwingli's approach, his theology, his ecclesiology, ultimately, it won the day for sure. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. Probably more bad than good. I would say probably more bad than good, honestly. All right. He was similar to Luther in many ways. His story had some parallel, but Luther was not a scholar first, whereas Zwingli was. Zwingli was thoroughly Erasmian. He was a total disciple of Erasmus, whereas Luther pushed back against Erasmus. Possibly, if Erasmus had been asked to choose between the church and Zwingli, he might even have been able to accept Zwingli. Because Zwingli was a humanist who didn't mind including the writing of the Latin authors and that kind of stuff. Whereas Luther said, get rid of those Latin authors. Don't have anything to do with those people. Luther rejected scholasticism altogether. Zwingli did not. Now, Zwingli's Reformation was much more radical than Luther. He basically ejected everything in Catholicism that wasn't in the Bible. I mean, there's a few exceptions. I'm sure you could think of some. But the bottom line is, it's kind of like let's look at everything the Catholics do, and let's get rid of everything that's not clearly supported by Scripture. He was more of a restorationist. He was less of a dialectic. Now, Luther was not a very good dialectic, but Zwingli was a big-time black and white guy. Totally. Zwinglianism was described somewhat sarcastically, but really quite accurately as, in quotes, four bare walls and a sermon. Okay, they got rid of musical instruments. Luther kept musical instruments. They got rid of no artwork whatsoever, even allowed in the building, whereas Luther allowed for artwork. The idea of clergy versus laity, which Luther accepted, well, Zwingli, it's debatable. Probably they had a little bit of that going on. All right, so. So let's give you a little bit of the history of Zwingli. He was he was fairly well educated. He wasn't from a wealthy family, but he was quite well educated. In 1512, although he was training as a priest, he ended up being a soldier. By the way, what do they call the guard at the papal palace? Right, because back in the Middle Ages, the Swiss were the best soldiers. Everybody knew it. So if you could get Swiss soldiers to fight on your side, that gave you a big leg up. Something about the mountains or whatever. I don't know what it was. But so the Swiss were always getting caught up in all these wars. But none of the wars were even being fought in Switzerland typically. They'd be fought in Italy or in France or in Flanders or wherever. And they're forever being called up and serving all these different wars. And Zwingli got caught up in two of those. In one, he serves as an actual soldier. You know, I don't know if he actually killed anybody or not, but carrying a sword and fighting. He was in another war in 1515. This time he was serving as a chaplain, but nevertheless, probably with a sword on his side. He fought in Italy and France in wars that had nothing to do. So at first, his was a political reaction. He just said, no more fighting in your stupid wars. He was a nationalist. I don't think Luther was a nationalist. He was a Swiss nationalist.
He was never ordained then, right? He was studying. Did he get ordained? I see here that the Dominicans tried to get him to join the order, but he refused. He didn't do it.
I don't think he was a priest.
Then would he be the first one outside of the clergy to kind of begin to push in a different direction?
That had a significant influence? Yeah? Calvin was definitely never a priest, that's for sure. All right. Now, in 1513, he began to study Greek. He was a brilliant Greek scholar. Luther was as well. I kind of understated Luther, but Melanchthon was even a greater Greek scholar than Luther. Zwingli was passionate about studying Greek. His nature was to be more like Erasmus, certainly, than Luther. He had a more intellectual outlook. In 1514, he befriended this guy, Oco Lampadius, another one of the reformers. By the way, it was really the Swiss Reformations, plural. There were several parallel reformations going on in Switzerland. Oco Lampadius, I don't know how to say his name, his began earlier. His ultimately was less radical than that of Zwingli. There were a number of reformations happening in Switzerland at the time, one of which was in Zurich. And ultimately, he wasn't the first reformer even in Zurich. Ultimately, he became the most important reformer in Zurich. And he essentially became the head of the Swiss Reformation, essentially. But he was mentored by this guy, Oco Lampadius, who said, there's but one thing that we should look for in the Holy Scripture, and that is Jesus Christ. So you see the sense of Erasmus there. You see Luther there. 1516, he moved to a small town called Iseldelen, where he served as a curate, I think. It may be the level below a priest. I don't know. He must have been a priest. I don't know. Maybe it was a monk or something. Anyway, he was serving as a minister for a local church. Let's just say that. That's when he became a reformer in 1516. In 1518, he moved to Zurich. Of course, by then, Luther had started his Reformation. And very soon after ending up in Zurich, he became the head of the Reformation in Zurich. His Reformation was much more gradual than that of Luther. All right, so he let's change that. But ultimately, it was more thorough. A more gradual, but more thorough Reformation. He disputed with Faber, this Catholic priest who was a hated enemy. And he said to Faber, I will have no other judge than the gospel. And Faber said, the gospel, the gospel, the gospel. Why is everybody talking about the gospel? Yeah, this is a Catholic priest. Imagine that. Wow. All right. So in 1523, his Reformation, let's say here's where he started as an Erasmian Catholic. Here's where he ended up. In 1523, he was probably only about halfway there, even, and that's after 7 years of his Reformation. Okay? But in 1524, within his movement, the Anabaptist movement started. Okay? And they left him way behind. So the Anabaptist movement was born out of Zwingli's movement, the Swiss Reformation. He was hanging out with these guys, Sattler and Grebel and Blaurock, these early Anabaptists, all of whom were executed, by the way. Every single one. No, wait, one of them died of plague. Would have been executed if he hadn't died of plague. They all were executed. If you ask who led the Anabaptist movement, they had to, yet to live at least 2 years to lead a movement. They were all killed within 2 years, all of them. Basically, baptism in the Anabaptist movement was preparation for martyrdom. That is not an overstatement, folks, at all. And we're talking about not just the leaders. It's very, very serious. So anyway, so there was a meeting of these guys, Sattler and Grebel and all these guys, and they, including Zwingli, agreed that baptism required faith. And therefore, baptism was for adults only. All right? And he was sitting around a table with equals. Because remember, he wasn't like later Calvin, who was virtually like a head of state. All right? So he was not ruling Zurich. He was heading the Reformation in Zurich. So anyway, he left that meeting and he said, whoops, wait a minute, that was a mistake. Now, why do you think that Zwingli would back off and return to infant baptism? Any thoughts? That's a hard question, by the way. It's not obvious. Because it would certainly seem to be that faith would be required for baptism, because we're saved when we're baptized. And if salvation is by faith alone and we're saved when we're baptized, how does that work? So any thoughts?
Is it because of the plague?
No.
No.
I don't think so. That's a good thought, though, because, you know, people are dying of plague. I would say something like the plague might have affected the move toward infant baptism. It's because of church and state. Because baptism was citizenship. Okay? Baptism was citizenship. He had no intention of moving away from the magisterial church. So his was part of the magisterial Reformation. The Anabaptist church was not. Okay? So the bottom line is, to deny baptism to infants was to deny citizenship to them. All right? And so what the Catholic Church had taught for a thousand years is that baptism cures original sin. It doesn't cure sins committed later. And so, and by the way, he didn't even agree with that. He ultimately decided baptism cures absolutely nothing. He was the first one to say that baptism doesn't forgive anything. Luther believed in a kind of baptismal regeneration, but Zwingli completely rejected baptismal regeneration. We'll talk about that. All right?
Zwingli, it was just a citizenship thing?
I wouldn't say it was just a citizenship thing, but put it this way, you cannot have magisterial Reformation without infant baptism. Or put it this way, if you could, it would be require something completely different than what they had before then. Okay? And you know, if you want to do a genealogy studies, you look at baptism lists. You don't look at, you know, birth certificates. So the baptism list, that was citizenship. Okay? And somebody's trying to talk to me, but I'm going to ignore them. All right, January 1525, he engaged in a debate with the Anabaptist Grable, and he won the debate. Well, surprise, surprise, surprise. Of course he did. It was staged, and he was guaranteed to win. He didn't win because he's scripturally correct. He won because he was the head honcho of the Reformation there. So what he did was this. He created the idea that baptism is an ordinance. Does it say there? An ordinance. It's not a sacrament, it's an ordinance. And he basically said, baptism in Christianity is like circumcision in Judaism. Okay, because circumcision is a symbol. It literally is a symbol. Now, it's a command. It's obedience. So not doing it would bring about consequences. And so basically he said, baptism is merely a symbol of something that's already happened. All right? And so he said, baptism is an ordinance. So this is the first time that we know of in all history that it was taught what is now taught in almost all Protestant churches. In fact, almost all evangelical churches teach that baptism is a symbol. It's an outward sign of an inward grace. So if anybody ever tells you that, said, did you know that it was the first person to ever teach that was Zwingli? How do you explain the fact that literally no Christian taught that for over 1,500 years? Explain that for me, please. Well, actually slightly under 1,500 years, but whatever. Okay? So this word ordinance, not a sacrament. So Luther said that baptism and the Lord's Supper are sacraments. The Catholics have seven sacraments. Luther says there are two sacraments. And Zwingli says there are no sacraments. And this is crucial to Zwingli, which is why he can't back down when he has his thing with Luther. All right, to him, the Lord's Supper is merely an ordinance. And by the way, for us, you could say that we also agree that the Lord's Supper is an ordinance as opposed to a sacrament. Now, I don't think we'd say baptism is a sacrament, but I'm running out of proper use of vocabulary there, but hopefully you get what I'm talking about. All right, here we go. The sacraments, in this quote, by which he means ordinances, are given to us as a public testimony of that grace which is previously present to every individual. Thus, baptism is administered in the presence of the church to one who, before receiving it, either confessed the religion of Christ or has the word of promise, whereby he is known to belong to the church. Faith, therefore, has been present before he receives baptism and is not given by baptism. But when an infant is offered, the question is asked whether its parents offer it for baptism. By baptism, therefore, the church public receives one who has previously been received through grace. Hence, baptism does not convey grace, but the church certifies that grace has been given to him to whom it is administered. This is the modern doctrine of baptism. So now you know when it was created and by whom it was created. That is Zwingli. And so he would say it's the equivalent of circumcision, whereas Paul said baptism is spiritual circumcision. He said something quite different. So he denied baptismal regeneration, whereas the Anabaptists and Luther agreed in baptismal regeneration, but the denial of baptismal regeneration is general to evangelicalism as a whole, with a few exceptions, by the way. All right, so as Reform picked up pace after 1524, the Mass wasn't outlawed in Zurich until 1525, which is what, 9 years after it began as Reform. They began to not have monks and nuns anymore, no more Masses. At that point, they started getting married. He got married, but he died soon thereafter, his poor wife. He rejected transubstantiation, because the Lord's Supper is merely a remembrance. And that reminds us of the colloquy at Marburg, in which he had the don't, you know, step across the line moment with Luther, which really destroyed the unity of the Protestant movement. Now, he was a total predestination. I would say, here's the truth, here's Calvinism, and I would say, all right, Luther is about here, Melanchthon is about here, and Zwingli is all the way over here. He's with Augustine, and probably even beyond Augustine. Wow. Right? In fact, maybe even beyond Calvin, actually. Although, I don't know about that. Those individuals who end up damned forever in hell are also eternally determined by God for that fate. So he made God the author of evil. He made God the one who chooses the vast majority to go to hell. All right. Now, by the way, I'm purposely not going to go over the scriptures that kind of mean this, because what we're going to do is an activity after lunch. Well, I won't tell you, but we're going to divide up into two groups and we're going to debate each other on Calvinism. It's going to be fun. So you're either going to be pro or anti-Calvinist. So just, you know, you're going to have to be able to take both sides. All right. God's sovereignty was the first principle of Christian thought, and it is the hub that holds everything together. Now, which of God's qualities is the hub that holds everything together? Ah, that's like, I knew you'd say that. Because, see, in today's church, that's what we believe. Any church which holds God's qualities out of balance has a theology problem. All right? And I knew you'd say that. I disagree with you, though. Now, I do believe this. God's justice and his love met at the cross. For those who accept Jesus, love beats justice. But for those who don't, justice beats love. So I would say his holiness, his justice, his sovereignty, I'm not going to say they're equal, mathematically equal. But I would say this. You know, wherever they're supposed to actually fall, equal or whatever it is, if we're out of balance, that's a problem. And I believe Christianity today, including ICOC, is imbalanced. Mm. Okay? And as evidenced by your response. But Zwingli is, but I would say, probably only somewhat out of balance, not hugely out of balance, you know? How many lessons have you heard about judgment? How many lessons have you heard about hell and about God's justice, maybe his holiness? So anyway, but talk about being out of balance. Look at that. That's crazy. That is crazy. In the early 1700s, it was, you know, fire and brimstone, right? It was God's judgment. This is not God's judgment. This is his sovereignty. Okay? And if you say sovereignty outweighs all the qualities of God, you could have God send, yeah, choosing to send people out. That's a piece of cake. Okay, were you going to make a comment?
No.
All right, so, I don't really like Zwingli. Not really. I like Luther. Look at, all pictures of him are like that. This guy was just a...
He was sober.
Okay, we'll go serious, sober, angry.
Grave.
All right, the same deed which is done at the instigation and direction of God brings honor to him, while it is a crime and a sin to man. Although he impels men to some deed which is wickedness, until the instrument that performs it yet is not such unto himself. In other words, he forces people to do evil.
But he's not evil.
Yeah. That's a pretty evil theology right there. By the way, do you believe in baptismal regeneration? I got in trouble. There's a fellow teacher in our movement who wrote me a letter saying, bro, you need to back off on this. You're wrong. It was a person at that meeting, by the way, a few days ago, who's one of my best friends. I love him to death. And it's probably more vocabulary than anything. All right. So do you believe in baptismal regeneration? So you know what I did? I read Wikipedia. And I say, yeah, I believe in baptism. All right. Wikipedia. Baptism of regeneration is the name given to doctrines by major Christian denominations which maintain that salvation is intimately linked to the act of baptism. And I believe salvation is intimately linked to the act of baptism. So I'm a baptismal regenerationist. See, the thing is, the evangelical world has baptismal regeneration is just a dirty word. It's like, it's a dirty word because they say baptismal regeneration is work salvation. Okay, so whether we are or we're not, All right. All right, mass is outlaw, blah, blah, blah. I don't have much more to say about Zwingli. I will say this. He died with a sword in his hand fighting in a battle. The battle, the second battle of Kappel, what happened was a Roman prince basically wanted to take Zurich, and so he's defending the city. He was in the battlefield and he was killed in battle. 1531, he wasn't that old. Well, he's maybe upper 40s at the time. So that's Zwingli. Any questions about Zwingli? So we're going to do two things before lunch. We may not finish the Anabaptist movement, but Zwingli. This is Reformed theology. Reformed theology. I'm going to give you a list eventually of the churches which formally are Reformed theology, but basically all Protestants pretty much, well, it's complicated, all right, because the Methodists are not Reformed, okay? So, the Anabaptist movement, all right, these guys are heroes to us, and rightly so. They're also known as the Radical Reformation, as opposed to the Magisterial Reformation. The Radical Reformation, basically their idea is, rather than go back to Augustine, why don't we go back to the good old B-I-B-L-E, you know? The B-I-B-L-E, that's the book for me. Stand alone in the Word of God, the B-I-B-L-E. So, but it did, this thing started, we know where, we know when, 1524, Zurich. People debate this. They say there were multiple Anabaptist beginnings. I've read their books, and I find it completely unconvincing. So you can trace it to, you can give names, dates, and even the building that it happened in. There was a meeting in the home of, I believe it was Felix Mons, I'm not sure. No, it was Sattler's house, I guess. So these guys get, don't worry about all the names. All right. The bottom line is, unlike Luther and Zwingli and Calvin, the names aren't that important because they all got killed. There's so many killed, it's hard to even say who the main person was. So, but the only name you probably need to know within a baptism is Menno Simons. Anyway, so they had this meeting in which they decided that baptism requires faith. But really, there were two things that created the Anabaptist movement. Two things. And which was more important, I don't know. But basically, the idea that to be a Christian, you need to be a Christian. You know, in other words, that your life matters. That whether you are like Christ or not has an effect on whether you are in fact a Christian or not. And that's what they were trying to establish. In fact, in a magisterial church, you can't be the church. Now, a magisterial church could possibly have some Christians in it, but the magisterial church cannot really be a manifestation of the church that Jesus set up, because the church that Jesus set up is made out of people who are following him. But if you have a magisterial church, that means every single citizen in your country is in your church. So what percentage of people in any country at any time would be true disciples of Jesus? I don't know. Maybe there might have been some place that had 20% one time somewhere. I don't know. So the idea of a magisterial church is sort of like jumbo shrimp. or compassionate Republicans. You know, there's no such thing. Just kidding. That's a joke. Yeah. Or tax-cutting Democrats, all equal on that. All right. So, but because they rejected infant baptism, they clearly and unmistakably rejected the idea of church and state being conjoined. All right? But therefore, in accepting that baptism requires faith, then they rejected the magisterial reformation. There's no way you could not do, with doing one, there's no way you can also do the other. Not really. Unless you change the entire terms of citizenship. I suppose you could base citizenship on something other than baptism. Sure, I mean, in America we don't have baptism as citizenship, so I guess you could have. But in their culture it seemed impossible. It's hard to exaggerate the relevance, importance of the separation of church and state, because religious toleration is what caused the Second Reformation. Because without religious toleration, you can't have a Christian church. Now, you can have Christians, but you can't have a Christian church. And those Christians are probably going to live outside of that church in fear of death. They don't have to. You know, I believe you could attend a Catholic church and go to heaven. I actually believe that. It's hard for me to imagine that he would, but I think it is probably possible to attend a Catholic church. And you don't have the Holy Spirit instantly ripped out of your body when you enter into that building or something like that. But anyway, the bottom line is, unless I'm wrong, the church is made out of baptized, committed believers who are trying to live a holy life. Mm-hmm. Unless I get it wrong. And so as long as you have the magisterial reformation, arguably the church has not been restored to the form that God intended it. Again, I'm not saying that you can't be a Christian. I'm not saying if you're a Lutheran, you're not a Christian. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying the entire system. And by the way, Lutheranism doesn't require a church-state connection. Neither does Catholicism. But the bottom line is, the second Protestant Reformation happened when Christendom fell. And Christendom fell when religious toleration became accepted. First in Holland, then in Rhode Island, then in Pennsylvania, then in England, then throughout the American colonies, and then ultimately a lot of places. So there's a reason the center of gravity of Christianity for almost 200 years was Holland and England. There's a reason for that. Because they had religious toleration. And, you know, people complain about all the denominations. I can't blame them. There's an awful lot of denominations. It's kind of ridiculous. But, you know, as of 1550, and there were really only about six denominations. There was a Coptic, Orthodox, Jacobite, Catholic, Lutheran, and, I don't know, Zwingliite. Because it was magisterial, and you know, and the church was defined by the state, or at least by some state somewhere having it. Anyway, I'm probably going on and on too long on that. Yes.
So, guys, what you're going to see through church history is all these characters, and if we had a more extensive syllabi, I would probably have one of the assignments just do a book report or do a but, you know, get some kind of biography report on one of these characters, you know, that if you did one on Mino Simons, or you did one on Zwingli, or you did one on Calvin, or Luther, or Bart W. Stone, or Alexander Campbell, or, you know, or David Lipscomb, you're going to learn a lot of history. So that's a thought, that if you want to do further reading besides John's book, you might
want to
read some biography.
Yep. This one here, the one on Luther, that's a great one. Thomas Aquinas, what's his name? His biography, it's thick. It's awesome. No, anyway. All right, so here we go. Kind of a list of things about the Anabaptists. Believer baptism only. And what they did was they just baptized each other. They just kind of, this guy named Blaurock was the first one to get baptized. He's famous for that. And then he baptized the rest of them. They actually did pouring for just a very, very brief period of time. And then they converted over to doing immersions. They rejected church state, pacifists. Now, almost all Anabaptists are pacifists. There's one group there in the city of Münster, which is in Germany near Holland, that had an apocalyptic view and then therefore sort of did a church-state joining and warfare, and that totally blew up in their face. Oh, my goodness. This is a terrible, terrible story.
What were they called?
Dead. All got killed. Every single one of them. The Münsterites. This Melchior Hoffman was an Anabaptist who moved in the direction of millennialism and apocalypticism. That there's always an apocalyptic millennial strain in
they hold themselves up in like a fortification, didn't they?
Well, in the city of Münster. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think I remember reading something about this. Yeah,
yeah, that's crazy. This was a utter disaster in the Anabaptist movement. It destroyed the Anabaptist movement virtually completely. We'll see. That did a funny thing to the Baptist movement. Because the Baptist movement was really just the Anabaptist movement revisited. But there's no way they would ever call themselves Anabaptists. Are you kidding? It's like you know calling yourself a cult. It was that name was persona non grata or whatever. Okay. So there's a very strong connection between restorationism and pacifism. But especially during the time of Christendom, because you have to reject state to accept this church. So pacifism was fairly natural to them. A very, very strong emphasis on personal holiness, because they were synergists rather than monergists. And, you sometimes wonder why any Calvinists are even being very righteous. Why do they bother? And yet you got to admit there's some pretty awesomely committed Calvinists. So be careful what you say, because, you might argue yourself into a corner. But really, what is the motivation for doing awesome good stuff if God's already chosen? I mean, you could say, well, it's just because I love God. But why would you love a guy who would do that to all those other people, But anyway, these guys... You've probably heard stories about the people who were martyring the Christians in the first, second, and third century. These people lived amazing lives, incredible, true philosophers. In my book, there's some great quotes, and you can find just a bunch of these. These people are saying that, man, these people who were murdering, they're amazing people. These are the most Christian people you ever met. They were so much more Christian than all the people around them. Other than, I'm sure, an individual here and there, these guys were living the life. No kidding, because your average lifespan was, might have been a year or two. Baptism was preparation for martyrdom. I am not exaggerating one bit. Pretty intense.
John, would you say that, obviously, Luther gets, a lot of the credit in terms of the Reformation, but would you say that this probably our most direct ancestor in terms of the Reformation?
Historically, no.
No.
No. See, basically, there were three separate Anabaptist movements. The first one being the one that created Mennonites and Hutterites and all that. Second one, creating the Baptist Church. And the third one, creating us. By the way, the Mormons would say they were part of that, which is actually true. A bizarre thing of history, a very bizarre thing of history. All right. Anyway, so they rejected double predestination. Formally, it's hard to explain. It's in my book. It takes a couple of pages to explain it. They did not accept baptismal regeneration, which is really weird, because they taught baptism by immersion, as required. And blah, blah, blah. And they would absolutely die in a heartbeat to defend that doctrine. And yet, technically, they do not believe that you're saved when you're baptized. Okay, it's difficult to explain it, why they went that way, but basically it was a pendulum swing against the Zwinglian doctrine of baptism. So they said, well, if Zwingli is going to do that, we're not going to go that way. All right, so that is kind of very, very surprising. So we even have to talk then about baptismal cognizance, which is not really for this course probably, but viciously persecuted, also very schismatic. Here's one thing. Bear in mind, whenever you have a restoration mindset, which is we're trying to reestablish what the apostles established in the first century, that philosophy is inherently schismatic. In other words, it tends to produce division after division after division. How do I know that? Because history has no exceptions to this. So, for example, the Hussites just splintered like crazy. And the Anabaptists splintered. Because if you're saying we're trying to restore the essential, that's what a great philosophy. In matters of essential, essential matters unity, in non-essential matters a liberality, what a great statement. Lots of people have said that and divided over things that we kind of go, that was an essential? So the question always comes down to this is, what is essential? People do not agree on that list. But I would say this, we should certainly think carefully about what is essential. Church history tells us that's important. Either that or you could be like a Quaker or a Pietist and say nothing's essential, so it's all good. Now you can go that way out. And then I think there is a middle ground between biblicism, pure biblicism, and, like the Quakers. The Quakers are fascinating. We've got to study the Quakers, even though they're not that important today. All right, so they were schismatic. So you're going to have your Hutterites, you're going to have your Mennonites, you're going to have your Amish, and there were many many groups, so many of which did not survive, and they divided over millennialism, they divided over baptism, they were huge on church discipline. There's an interesting essay on church discipline in volume 3. That's an interesting thing to think about, church discipline. The evangelical movement has gotten around the problem of church discipline is they just don't do it. So that solved that problem. All right. Anyway, Felix Mons was ordered, executed, and drowned by Zwingli himself. And he was friends. He was in the room. He was in the room when they had this discussion, in which, in principle, in the room on that day, he agreed with him. And yet although he didn't technically order his execution because he didn't have that role, that was not his political place, he basically, kind of like Paul with Stephen. He didn't order Stephen's death, but all right. Michael Sattler burned at the stake in 1527. The first theologian of the movement was Balthasar Hubmaier. Burned at the stake in 1528. And when they're, oh, I think I've got some cool quotes here. Okay, they taught synergism, not monergism. Taught prevenient grace. That's the first time I've used the phrase prevenient grace. I'll get back to the idea of prevenient grace when I get to that other thing. Never mind. And what's interesting is the Catholics burned them at the stake. All right? So that's a Catholic Anabaptist execution. But the Zwingliites, the Reformed, they drowned them. The word Anabaptist means baptized again. And by the way, the Anabaptists didn't agree with that. You know, we don't agree that somebody, we say you're just baptized. You're not being baptized again. Just being baptized, that thing that happened. We even just say sprinkle, just so we can kind of pull that trick of phrase there. Anyway, I don't know. So in 1529, the Catholic Emperor Charles V declared capital punishment for rebaptism. In other words, anybody who was rebaptized, execution, automatic. Now, luckily, it was a lot safer to be an Anabaptist in Switzerland. No, So they said, all right, you want to be baptized again? They'd row them out into the middle of the lake, tie a rock to them, and throw them over the edge.
Whoa.
You know what? That's better than being burned at the stake, though, actually.
Yeah, I agree.
Probably.
Yeah.
All right, there are tens of thousands, many, many tens of thousands killed. On the scale of any of the Roman persecutions of the church, there was one thing where they killed 350 of them in a single day. The count of Alze, who was overseeing it, said, "What shall I do? The more I execute, the more they increase." Sounds like the first century church, doesn't it? It's because that's essentially what it was. In fact, ultimately, the empire appointed 1,000 people, full-time employees, as special police to find these guys. And you figure if their job was to find people to execute, they must have executed at least 30 or 40 apiece, otherwise they would have lost their job. That's just the Catholic end of the persecution. But nevertheless, it sped to Germany, to Tyrol, which is northern Italy, to Moravia, to Holland, like wildfire. Okay? Is it 12 yet?
Yeah, it's 12.
All right. If I was 3 minutes away from finishing Anabaptism, I would finish. I'm about 10 minutes away. I'm hungry. We're stopping. You bet. It's fun. Thank you, Turnwall, for hanging out with this. Oh, that was only 51 minutes. Yeah.
So.